Well, thanks a lot for inviting me here. So I guess I'm the beginning of my talk is going to be a bit about the Planck satellite. And then I'm sort of going to talk about some newer and sort of more speculative, futuristic things having to do with the kinetic Sunyaev-Soldovich effect, and also 21 centimeter observations. It's, I know Kendrick is involved in CHIME and probably other people. I'll sort of explain some of the connections and some of the challenges. So let's see. Okay, so this is an outline of my talk. So I'll just review some of what we learned about Planck. And then, I mean, there's a lot that can be said about after Planck. The last time I came here 4 years ago, I talked about B-modes, and I'm not really going to talk about that because I think you've probably heard a lot of other talks. So there are basically two sort of future directions to do the large angular scales from space, and there the emphasis is polarization, and then from the ground to do smaller scales at higher sensitivity. And the kinetics and Sunyaev-Soldovich effect is just one example, so I'm just going to talk about that. And then correlations with 21 centimeter. So people have said that there are lots of opportunities and things that can be learned from cross-correlating CMB data with other data, and this is one of them. So Planck is basically, for the most part, over. In July, there were the last set of cosmology papers. A few are sort of lagging behind. It was launched in 2009 after many delays and many years of preparation. And here we have the final papers, and probably the biggest new thing from what is included is the low L polarization, which was the hardest thing to do in a reliable way. Okay, so we back up, and I just kept this slide, so I guess we have this 2.75 degree background, and you know, this was a big moment. This killed steady state cosmology, and you know, then there's sort of the long familiar story. So what are we doing now, or sort of what remains to be done? Well, the 21 centimeter that I'll talk about later is looking at very low frequencies to look at spectral distortions by the, you know, the 21 centimeter hyperfine transition, and that, you know, can be red. So that would be 1.4 gigahertz, and then that gets redshifted to different ranges, and you can see galaxies, you can see the first stars, and quasars. So this is sort of cosmic dawn. And in a way, Planck and other experiments at redshift of 1,000 characterized the initial conditions. And now we're sort of looking at the, you know, intermediate universe, what happened between, which is, you know, nonlinear and rather difficult. So here is the, you know, this is a sort of simplification. This is not for today for doing so-called precision cosmology, but for sort of understanding qualitatively what you see. So here, the universe is expanding, and then this is a backward light cone, and most of the CMB is anisotropy, so the primordial part are imprinted at redshift of 1,000 about, and we sort of see this, you know, snapshot of the Big Bang, this huge circle, sphere that's the size of our horizon. And then if you want to give a simplified explanation, you say, well, the photons, you know, scatter toward us, propagate toward us without ever rescattering. But now sort of the interesting things are to look at gravitational lensing more precisely. So this sort of pattern gets distorted. And then there's a hot gas or ionized gas that's moving and distorts that. And those are sort of more the interesting things that you can see in the CMB, you know, beyond the main primary anisotropy. So this is the density, the variation, the Doppler velocity term, the gravitational potential, and then there's also a term that the integrated Sachs-Wolf term that arises is the photons propagate toward us. So if you go into a potential well, the photon, and then it its depth changes, that changes the temperature. So here's Planck that's sort of human scale, and the meter is sort of order of a mirror. And I guess one of the important things to appreciate is that this kind of experiment is diffraction limited. So basically the resolution gets cut off by the size of the mirror. From the ground, you can deploy and, you know, 6 and 10 meter telescopes and get much better resolution, and that's sort of what is being done and will be done even more so with 100,000 detectors in the future. These are the horns from Planck. So these are sort of single mode microwave feed horns. And the new thing was the bolometric high frequency instrument. And these are high frequencies that you just can't get from the ground because of the atmosphere. So with CMB, there are lots of foregrounds. There's dust in our galaxy. There's synchrotron radiation. There's free-free, which is Bremsstrahlung. And then there's this sort of window where you see mostly the CMB. And these things have to be subtracted. So this is the CMB signal, and you can see that there is a window where you see mainly CMB, and for polarization, not all of these foregrounds are polarized, but the signal is much smaller. So the strategy is to gather a lot of photons in a lot of different frequencies so you can separate out these different components and then do science. So it sort of depends if you're interested in the galaxy or Sonia Ive-Saldovich, you would separate out different components than if you were doing wanted to do cosmology. So these are the raw temperature maps from the lowest frequency to the highest frequency. And you see the cleanest is probably this map. And here you, the galaxy is in the equator in these coordinates. So here you see dust. You don't see any of the microwave background, which is cleanest around the galactic poles. Then you go down in frequency and you see less and less dust. And then this is synchrotron radiation. And then there are maps from the ground at even lower frequencies where all you see is synchrotron. And for these are the polarization maps, so it's sort of more or less the same story. The ones in the middle are the cleanest. And then I guess I said that you can you know, remove all the, so this is for doing cosmology, so the without the galactic components, these gray lines show what's cut. And the sort of test is, well, this looks more or less isotropic. You can't see the galaxy anymore. So this is sort of the visual proof that this cleaning can actually or has successfully been done. And then with arrows here, this is a polarization map. So the arrows point in the direction where you know, you would orient your polarizer to get the highest temperature. And since the cosmological models that seem to fit are, you know, it's a spherically symmetric or isotropic statistical process, the power spectra sort of summarize, if you don't have any non-Gaussianity, all the statistically interesting information in the signal. And here you see the temperature extended by these other colors are ground-based data at smaller angular scales. So this is a 20th of a degree. And then this is the quadrupole. Here you see the EE polarization. And here you see the B-mode polarization, which is from gravitational lensing, the cross correlation, and then this is the gravitational lensing. So this is sort of a lot of the Planck results in a sort of simple summary plot. And then when you look at the theoretical analysis, there's this six parameter model that seems to be able to explain all of the data. So this could be seen either as a triumph or a big disappointment. I mean, I think a lot of us wish that there would have been more, that there would have been surprises. The spectral index, which is not scale invariant, not equal to one, the high significance, that is primordial, as well as the amplitude. And then this is the reionization optical depth, which has a lot to do with quasars, the first population three stars being formed. And then these are sort of the familiar parameters. You can also, these are the 2018 plots, and The residuals are, I think, more interesting to look at. You know, can you see some pattern of what doesn't work? I mean, here you can see the fit is pretty good. Here there's a lot of scatter because of cosmic variance. You can just look at one sky. So with each L mode, there are just two L realizations of a Gaussian random process. You see a bit of deficit of power and sort of a dip here, but it's not very significant. So you can either, if you're a theorist, look for models that can explain this, or if you like, you know, want to be an orthodox advocate of concordance, say, oh, well, this is, you know, the statistics are insignificant. This is just a fluke. And then you see sort of the same thing with polarization. And this is a polarization cross-correlation. There's some runs here where you see some patterns of going above and below, but that could likely be leakage. Okay, I'll just show a few more slides from Planck. So this is the sort of improvement of the cosmological parameters with Planck 2019, the Hubble constant. From the CMB is greatly narrowed down. Not everyone is happy with this, because this disagrees with sort of more conventional measures of the Hubble constant by little over 3 sigma. And the same with the amplitude of the perturbations, which is sigma 8. And here you can this is a sort of selection of inflationary models. Spida the 4 would be up here. And then the Starobinsky model and Higgs inflation is pretty much at the middle of the bullseye, but that's not that significant. So this axis, the tilt of the spectrum, is hard to improve because of cosmic variance, but with B-mode experiments, this is going to really improve a lot. So the sort of goal is, or promises are, the tensor to scalar ratio with 1 sigma of 10 to the -3 or something like that. So a lot of these models will die, and that will be an interesting story to follow that might take quite a while. Okay, so this is the sort of concordance scorecard with sort of boring inflation, and you've got the spatially flat universe, ALMA scale invariant spectrum, and very little non-Gaussianity, very few isocurvature perturbations, and a very small fraction of topological defects is contributing to the anisotropies allowed. This is my last sort of Planck review type slide. I mentioned that the tensor to scalar ratio will be measured very accurately. So in linear theory, this is basically a scalar potential, and you can just make these E-mode patterns with scalar modes of freedom. But with gravity waves, you can excite these B-modes. So measuring these will be interesting because that constrains the scale of inflation. Okay, so now we're going to go a little more into things that have where one can improve a lot in the future. So these are so-called secondary CMB anisotropies. And what that means is basically, things that happen to the photons between the redshift of 1,000 and when they propagate to us today. This isn't an exhaustive list, but there's gravitational lensing. And this has been detected and first using cross correlation and then at 23 sigma by Planck. And this will get a lot better. So the CMB is sort of the farthest screen that you can look at, and you see whether these motifs, how they're deformed in a statistical sense, and you can tell things about the matter that lies between the surface of less scattering and us today. Then there's rescattering by photons, by hot electrons, or just ionized electrons more generally. And there are two effects. There's to the extent that the electrons are very hot, they tend to drive the CMB photons to higher energies, and they create spectral distortions. And then the other effect is independent of the temperature. So if you have this cloud of ionized gas that's moving toward you, then it will the electrons that are scattered will be blue shifted, and that imprints patterns on the CMB map. So here we have a more detailed slide. So this is the kinetic effect. So tau is the optical depth, so roughly the probability of getting rescattered going through this cloud. And then you have the velocity compared to the speed of light. And this gives you a pattern that has exactly the same frequency spectrum as the primary anisotropies. So it's hard to disentangle. And then here we have this, if the cloud is hot, then you can take this dimensionless ratio with, let's see, there should be a temperature here compared to the electron rest mass in addition to the optical depth. And this takes the CMB is colder below 217 gigahertz and then hotter at higher temperatures. So this has a different template. So if you have enough frequencies, you can just, at least with ideal data analysis, take this out. So let's talk about the kinetics and Yaeve-Seldovich effect, which is more difficult because, two reasons. It has precisely the same frequency dependence. So you can't sort of do this component separation and make your Y distortion map. And it's much smaller in magnitude than the primary CMB anisotropy. So the best way, and perhaps almost the only way to detect it, is through cross correlations. So roughly speaking, you make from other data, you make a template. Well, what do you think? Where do you think it'll be positive? Where do you think it'll be negative? And then you connect, cross-correlate that with the black body signal in the sky. And this was exactly the same strategy that was used to first discover gravitational lensing. So this is Kendrick and collaborators and cross-correlating the W map map and then very large array radio galaxies to make a template. And that was 3.4 sigma. So Planck did a lot better because it has about twice the resolution of W map. And most of the lensing signal is on small angular scales. So this did not use any cross correlation. And with these new ground-based experiments, like CMB stage 4, this is going to hopefully measure the absolute neutrino masses. Okay, so what is the science behind the kinetic Sunyaev-Saltovich effect? So here is this is from the 2DF survey, redshift distortion. So you measure the power spectrum where in three dimensions where you have redshift and you assume redshift is spatial position, which is wrong because of the peculiar velocities. So these, they're sort of random and not so random motions with respect to the Hubble flow. And for this to work, you're just looking at differences in velocity. So this is a bit easier, but this gives you a lot of information. And then the fingers of God is where you have objects that are really close and are either orbiting or falling toward each other. And so they seem this, seems elongated. And then this is, I think this is Nick Kaiser who came up with pancakes of God. So you can see that here you have 20 megaparsecs, but then this has been flattened. So the things in front fall in, and the things fall away from you, and the things behind you toward you. So you get this redshift distortion. So this is all relative, but if we could measure absolute proper velocities, then that would be a nice thing. So that this is something that people have done, for example, with standard candles, with supernovae, and other things nearby. But with the Sunyaev-Saltovich effect, you're basically measuring the motion relative to the CMB rest frame. So you don't lose this accuracy with distance. Something can be halfway to the horizon, but if you its distortion is relative to the CMB rest frame and not relative to you. So this is why this is a good thing to do. So the current status is that so everybody knows that this kind of signal must exist. There's ionized gas, and and things move, so there must be a Kayasada effect. But since it's so much smaller, you have to sort of find some statistic to remove it from the primary anisotropies. And one method is to sort of look for collapsed heavy objects, and you know what is behind what, so you have a prediction for the both the sign of the temperature difference and the magnitude. So you form a statistic, sort of looking at certain directions in the sky. And then the other is to use something like some redshift survey to make a model of what you think the proper velocities should be. So then you make a template of what you think, mostly based on linear cosmological perturbation theory. The expectation is, and then you cross-correlate it, and the magnitude of this cross-correlation is your observable. So this probes, unfortunately, there are other things that are probed, where the baryons are, the ionized baryons, as well as a peculiar velocity field. And these, you know, the literature on this emphasizes these different factors differently. So this is sort of the first detection, one might say, based on this pairwise method. And you can see the that there is a signal here. So this proves that the method works. And this is another, I just showed one plot, but this is from Planck. And the thing is that it is emphasized in this paper without that strong evidence, is that you can see from the velocity gas that is, you know, outside the varial radius. So unlike the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, the gas doesn't have to be heated to be visible by this method. Okay, so now I'm going to turn to more sort of futuristic things that, so this is using 21 centimeter observations for, you know, cross correlations rather than galaxy surveys. And this is work with a student at UK Zeddon, Zara Cotter, and Kavalan Moodley. So the overall program is mainly looking for the BAO and intensity mapping, which is, you know, you see galaxies by their 21 centimeter emission, but you don't resolve single galaxies and make catalogs. You basically measure the power spectrum directly. And let's see, HIREX, which covers this redshift range over a large fraction of the southern sky. So this is an experiment in South Africa that is being built. And this is not very accessible from galaxy surveys, so that, and also relevant for dark energy. And the relevant things to sort of take away is, well, you're measuring this temperature in the sky, so there's position, there's this sort of unit vector, and then there's frequency, which is you know, the redshift of the 21 centimeter line. And then we have the galactic synchrotron emission, which is very smooth. So it's almost a power law. And this is a few orders of magnitude hotter than the emission from the galaxies beyond, I mean, in this redshift range. So you need to separate these two. And we need to exploit the fact that this is very smooth. So if we take the wave numbers in the radial direction parallel to the line of sight, this is almost all in these modes. And then the signal that you want has all sorts of transverse wave numbers. So this is a two-dimensional vector. I'm sort of making a flat sky. So this is a little simplified. And then this is sort of agnostic with respect to the K parallel. And no matter how you do the data analysis, you're throwing away all the low parallel K modes, because they're all contaminated by the galaxy. And then the signal that you can use is in these higher frequencies.
What's the difference between the contaminant and the parasitic contaminant?
Well, putting both means it's doubly evil.
Parasitic is more evil.
Yeah, it's evil. okay, so the slide is a little out of order. So you can also, the data for the SED is going to get a lot better with these new surveys, which have a lot of sensitivity and a lot of frequency on small angular scales. So that's sort of for the KSZ part of what you see. Now the problem is that the KSZ window function sort of averages over the whole line of sight. So if we're doing 21 centimeter stuff, we can't just take a simple correlation with a sort of average velocity along the line of sight, because that's been contaminated by the doubly evil galaxy. So the way around this is to use the bispectrum. And here we sort of, take the source term. So there's a density and the velocity, and there's also a density perturbation. And then at second order, you get this product. So what we want to do is cross-correlate something with this. And then this is going to be a bit like looking for, you know, bispectral non-Gaussianity, except there's another extra wave number in the line of sight direction, because your 21 centimeter data is three dimensional. So this is my sort of non-numerical way of understanding why you should get a signal. So you have, since we're looking at a three-point correlation function, you have three lines of sight here. I mean, we might do this in wave number, but it's easier to understand with these neighboring line of sights. And for the one farther away, which we probed through 21 centimeter, I put some heavy masses is the axis. So this is going to be the stuff that makes stuff in the line of sight move. And then sort of at 90 degrees out of phase, I put some matter close to the KS Z number of sites. I can probe this with another KS Z line. And basically, these arrows show the direction that you expect the matter to fall. So if I have sort of overdensities here correlated with overdensities here, even though this has a high wave number, it's falling toward the observer. So you get a signal even after averaging over the line of sight, which has a k parallel approximately equal to zero. So the signal comes from something that lags or leads by 90 degrees in phase, the, you know, one giving you a positive and one giving you a negative signal. And then if you would have over densities that are in phase or 180 degrees, that quadrature gives no KSZ signal. So this is sort of the thing to look for in the 21 centimeter maps. So I'll tell you a little about Hyrax, and then I'll tell you a little about why doing this experiment is quite hard. So this is a South African-led experiment that it's an international collaboration. There's Perimeter, McGill, and you know, lots of partners. I guess the radio transients and pulsar searches, this is maybe a little easier to do, but the dark energy and the 21 centimeter is sort of the design driver. This is the Hyrax. You see these a lot in South Africa. And this is, if you want to find out more, this is a paper about Hyrax. And I don't think this list of collaborators is completely up to date, but I'll just include it in the slides. And this, ultimately, this will be an array of 1,000 dishes in the Karut Desert near the SKA site. And the frequency range, so this is an active, matches a redshift range that I mentioned. And then the dish placement is sort of matched to get the resolution for the BAO peaks, which isn't what we're, this is sort of something secondary that you would do with the data. So this is complementary to the Canadian CHIME experiment, which instead uses cylindrical dishes. And you know, there's some differences, but this is, it's basically you cover different parts of the sky and can cross-correlate with different data sets. So there are more CMB experiments in the southern hemisphere than the northern hemisphere for, well, having to do with water vapor. So this is a sort of desolate part of South Africa where Hyrax will be deployed. So a lot of the correlation is numerical, so the data is digitized, and then analyzed. And this is the prototype. So I'll say a few, I think. How much time do I have?
2 minutes.
Oh, okay. Okay, so let's go back to the point about the galaxy being smooth and the signal that you want, you know, in the frequency direction, and the signal that you want is, you know, not smooth. There's a lot of variation. So that was what you used to separate the components. So these are, this is no longer the current dish design. I can say a few words why the design has changed. But basically, these are 6 meter dishes and center feed for the moment. And the wavelength is, you know, sort of up to 70 centimeters. So this is not very many wavelengths across. So this means that diffraction is a big problem. And, you know, unlike with optical telescopes where you have a secondary mirror and it doesn't cause that many problems, there are reflections between the dish and the feed that cause a lot of problems and create a complicated beam. So if you were a theorist and you were writing a forecast paper, you would take this, you know, perfectly Gaussian beam, and then you would say, well, you can do all of this stuff. And but it's not that simple. So let me first say, okay, so these are electromagnetic simulations. This is preliminary, and this is on an old dish design. So I want to give you these caveats, and I'm going to show you how the these are non-optimized, and so I'll show you an animation. So the scale is decibels. And 0 decibels is what you would get with an isotropic beam. So if you were, you know, averaging over all directions in the sky in the same way. So this is the main beam. And I'll show you the cross polarization pattern. And you can see it's very peaked. Here, that this is azimuthal angle, but then there are a lot of side lobes, and you know this is sort of 90 degrees, and you know it isn't. This is maybe half of isotropic, so the beam is not really just looking straight ahead, even though part of it is very concentrated. And then we can look at, let's see. I hope this works. Yeah. So this, this is sort of sweeping through all of the frequencies. And you can sort of see that if you have objects that are outside of your main beam, these are going to cause you a lot of problems. So at least this version of the beam is, it's not so nice.
Is this a simulation or a measurement?
This is a simulation. So basically, what is done here is there's sort of a CAD model of the surfaces in the feed, and then the simulation software sort of makes a transmitter. So there's this sending something out of into the feed, into the sky by this reciprocity theorem, if the numerics is correct. And there's no ground and no reflection off of other dishes, at least in this particular simulation. So I don't think people believe that these predictions are necessarily that accurate in detail, but so that you could use them to correct necessarily. But there's no reason to believe that the overall picture is not.
Presumably, they characterize the noise in the beam from these simulations. For example, the RMS variations in the window function, in the function of the beam.
Well, here there's no noise. So but this is just the beam shape.
But it's, well, I guess it's noise in the sense that you cannot predict it, right? So, because I mean, this looks like it just depends on like tiny details, which are not easy to predict. But presumably, they may be changed by as the beams as the switches rotate, because the gravity deforms the beam, right? So.
Well, I think the features come from interference and diffraction.
Yes.
Now the dish doesn't move. It's the sky drifts across the
dish ever moves because it has a point when the Jupiter is pointing in some direction. It has ability to move.
No. This is since this is a survey telescope. So most radio telescopes, you have some source and you sort of want to follow it across the sky. So it can rotate in the north-south direction, but basically you put it in a fixed location and then you watch the sky go around, you know, for a day or a few days. Then you move it and you take these strips because the goal is to see the whole sky. I mean, this is a big question. Do you believe the simulations? Do you, how can you measure it? How accurately? Let's see, I had a, this seemed to have gotten stuck. Okay, this is the cross polarization or the wrong polarization. So I just show this for completeness. So this is, you can also redesign the telescope, have different feeds. One thing that might be interesting is trying off-axis, like a lot of CMB telescopes generally do, but that has. Let's see, can I get the full screen? Okay, here are some other plots of the sort of, let's see, I can't. This is the cumulative power. And then this is sort of the differential power as a function of angle. This is a log plot. And perhaps more, here are the beams averaged over azimuthal direction. And here you see, I just put this in with CMB beams. So this is the low frequency instrument, and you can see sort of zero decibels that you get a lot, very good attenuation. So the beams that are sort of being considered for these different radio telescopes really see a lot of the horizon and a lot of things outside of the field of view. Just for comparison, this is a commercial corrugated feed horn, and 0 dB would be about here. So you have a factor of a thousandths in power in the far side lobes. So you're doing a lot worse than a feed horn. And here I can show you, and there's some anomalies in these plots, but the frequency dependence. So a lot of the frequency dependence will come from the beam rather than the signal, and this has to be separated. And here's sort of a similar plot from a Chime paper. I think this is sort of fitting the width of the beam. So this is a problem that everybody will encounter. And there are a lot of sort of coming up with a concept for the experiment and actually carrying it out successfully. There's quite a bit of work to be done. So in the Penzias and Wilson experiment, they had some pigeons that built a nest inside their horn in Pownville, New Jersey. And in South Africa, we have monkeys. I got this photograph from the web. So you could ask, well, what would the monkey do? Look like electromagnetically. And it would have a dielectric constant of close to water, which would be 80 at the relevant frequency. So it would be sort of like a perfect conductor. So I guess there are a lot of things to think about for making this 21 centimeter BAO and other things happen. Is a reality. But with the CMB, a lot of people thought when people wrote papers about lensing of the CMB, I think the first reaction was, well, this is science fiction. It's not going to be possible to do. And then, people work hard and hopefully the impossible will happen again. So thank you.
What is your opinion of the 21 centimeter edges experiment that we measured absorption from the first starlight UV radiation?
I'm skeptical, but I haven't really studied the experiment carefully. It would seem that for that sort of an experiment, the ideal experiment would be to try to do something like, FIRES, where you're making a differential measurement and you're sort of switching back between things. But the problem is that the wavelengths are so large, that's very hard to do. And I'm just surprised that, that is possible. And to do these sorts of experiments with all the problems with the beam and all of that, it's really a differential measurement, or the interferometry doesn't measure an absolute signal on the sky. So in a way, that's very much easier. But I don't have any real insight to share on that.
Can you say a little more about the science goals of Pyrex, particularly for dark energy? Presuming you get the monkeys out of it. I mean, you skipped over that pretty quick. What's the science reach that Pyrex could, what could it tell us about dark energy? W, equation of state, I mean, what?
Well, let's, I mean, it, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I mean, it basically gets the PAO peak in that redshift range, and it'll hopefully get do some of the things earlier than other experiments, because that's, you know, it's hard to get photometric redshifts and that. And that
is it going to be deep enough to tell us, for example, if W changes to rule out cosmological constant? Just to get from your talk what the takeaway would be.
The current PAO seems to have tension with the constant lambda. There's some tension between that and constant lambda. So is it that when it's trying to resolve that, I mean, there's some, I guess, a large error in the current.
Right. The question is whether this kind of experiment will help.
It seems that if you get better measurements, then.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you get the angular diameter distance in this, you know, redshift range.
This is what, about 2, you said 2.5?
0.8 to 2.5.
Okay, I just don't have a feeling of that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, it wasn't the.
I was wondering if what's the way to solve these really complicated beams as the way forward much into like very good simulation. Like, can you just measure it really precisely by having some source that you move over the instruments from which you know exactly the brightness? So what's the plan to have the beams that control basically?
Well, there are several options. So one option that is being studied is to use drones and you know, have a radio source, and you fly over and you measure the you know, the signal from the different dishes. The problem is that you need a very intense source, and it isn't really enough in the far field. Then there are other possibilities using point sources that transit. There's also a nice paper by the Chaim collaboration where they use a much larger radio telescope nearby. And so basically when you do interferometry, the beam is sort of the geometric mean of the two beams. And so there you can sort of make a spot and probe the, you know, different parts of the beam by resolving a source in the sky with you know, both the larger telescope and your dishes. There's also commercially, people can have used sort of near field sources, and then you can get the far field diffraction numerically. So these are all questions that I think haven't really been worked out. Then you have to know what the accuracy is that you need to know the beams and the numbers that I've heard from other collaborations are sort of around the percent level. There are other things that are a bit worrying where just having a beam from one source isn't enough, because there's also sort of relative phases that if you have dishes that aren't identical, then you get phase artifacts. So you would ideally, you know, the beam function is a complex function on the celestial sphere. Then there are also interactions between the dishes, between the dish and the ground. So the signal can go in one dish, bounce off the other, and that's a little different for the dishes in the periphery. So there's lots of work to be done.
So you need like 1% accuracy on the beam to do a cosmology,
I'm not sure of that figure, but that's the order of magnitude. I mean, also with interference, you get the square root of these powers. So what seems small in power can be more problematic than it would seem.
Right, I think we're just working on the same thing.